we collectively are forgetting. How many people now, if you ask them, what's the Holocaust about, would know? How many would know anything about when America entered World War II and why? Some of these things are very, very important, and even more important things are being forgotten. We've got a tendency now, if we don't like something in our history, to whitewash it. Let's take that statue down. Let's pretend that didn't happen. It's a bad thing. Joining me now to discuss the possibility we've all got amnesia is Joel Kotkin. He's a Presidential Fellow in Urban Futures at Chapman University and the Executive Director of the Centre for Opportunity Urbanism. His last book was The Human City, Urbanism for the Rest of Us. Joel Kotkin, welcome to Counterpoint.
Hi, it's my pleasure to be here.
Gee, the age of amnesia worries me because I think you could be right.
Well, I think it's clearly something that we're seeing. You know, it reminds me of what happens in authoritarian countries historically, or in the book I'm just finishing now, or the Middle Ages, where you basically either bury the past or you reshape it to fit a ideological mindset. Like, for instance, you know, instead of thinking that, let's say, the classical authors were, you know, brilliant and had all these tremendous insights, they represented paganism, and, you know, that was bad, and particularly in the early days of the Catholic Church. And then you have this in, let's say, in the Soviet Union or in today's China, for instance. A great example would be, you know, they're basically trying to airbrush, you know, the mass starvations caused by Mao and Tiananmen out of history. We just ignore that they happen. So there are things we ignore, and then there are things that we emphasize. And so the sense of any kind of historical balance is sort of lost. Now, look, every country has things that it should be ashamed of and things that need to be dealt with, whether it's our treatment here of African Americans and the indigenous people, and the same thing with the indigenous people of Australia. These are bad things. You have to deal with them. But you have to understand that much of the history is a very positive one. Think of all the, you know, millions of people who migrated to America or Canada or to Australia, and their lives were enormously improved from what they were experiencing back in Europe or in East Asia, for that matter. So, you know, I think that we've sort of lost any sort of sense of balance. And then because people don't know the basis, the historical timelines even, they're completely ignorant and unable to say, oh, this doesn't make any sense. I can just give you one little example just because I think it always sticks in people's minds. I teach a class. I do a whole class on the rise of socialism and why did socialism rise and what were the social reasons for it. And I put up a picture of Nikolai Lenin, probably as famous a visage as existed in the 20th century. Out of 34 kids, maybe four or five knew who Lenin was.
So when they say you can learn from history, a lot of kids are not, because they're not being, presumably not being taught it. You think we're close back to one aspect of the Middle Ages, which I thought was really interesting, where you were mentioning that there were beliefs which authority claimed were true and wanted to impose those on everyone. And what I found particularly interesting was that the university in Paris held a conclave to reassert the reality of demons that were supposedly infecting society. Now, at the time, people would have presumably said, well, it's the university, they must know what's going on. And maybe we see that sort of thing now, where we just put too much trust in what people who have an education say is the case.
It's constantly the case. I mean, whether it's on a scientific issue or whether it's on a sociological issue. And very often what will happen is they'll come up with a solution that in the real world can't possibly work, but it may work well on paper. And the problem is that increasingly, and this is very true of academia and to some extent in the media, people are so over-specialized. They only know, as Sorokin wrote many years ago, we know more and more about less and less. You know, academics, they know everything about women writers in the 17th century in Luxembourg. They know more about that than anybody will ever know. But if you ask them about the 18th century, they're lost. In other words, so what we don't have is kind of a general, if you will, cultural literacy, and that's really been lost on a mass basis. And, you know, those of us who make our living writing, it's very scary when you realize that, for instance, students don't read books. They just don't. And they certainly don't read them for pleasure. You know, they may read something that they need for an exam. Very often they'll just go to Google and answer the questions on Google. And so they don't ever have that experience of sitting down with a book, whether it's, you know, conservative or liberal, Marxist, whatever, and see all the subtleties of an argument and see the three dimensions. They only see very specific points. And therefore, they're really not well equipped to look at something and say, well, is this really true or not? Like, for instance, if you take the example of the climate issue. Now, I agree there's a problem there and, you know, things need to be addressed. But would you ever ask the question, well, what were they predicting 10 years ago or 20 years ago and how accurate was it? Just so you know that maybe the projections may not be exactly what's going to happen. Again, I'm not arguing for one side or the other, but just the whole argumentation. When people say the debate is over, the science is settled, it's scary. And by the way, it applies to many, many issues. Issues of family, issues of religion, issues of constitutionalism. I've had students come up to me and say, well, the Electoral College, which determines, you know, who gets elected president in this country, kid comes to me and says, oh, the Electoral College was created to protect slavery. And I said, no, it wasn't. It came from small states, most of which were free states in the North. And the big state at the time that didn't want the Electoral College was Virginia, which was a slave state. I mean, that, in other words, the ideological education that they're getting. So, A, they don't know much to start with, and then they're easily shaped by whatever the ideological approach of the media or academia is. And so they don't have any way of judging for themselves because they don't know enough to judge for themselves.
I'm Amanda Vanstone. You're on Radio National Counterpoint. We're talking with Joel Kotkin. He's Presidential Fellow in Urban Futures at Chapman University. And we're talking about collective amnesia, wiping out our past, giving us nothing on which to base our future. It's a very worrying thing, isn't it, that we compare this to the Middle Ages, where there were certain people who said what was happening, that was the rule, and everyone had to follow it. And I get the analogy that it sort of feels a bit like that now. If you say the wrong thing, you're jumped on, and everyone will tell you why you're wrong, mean-hearted, and don't understand. All of that's true. But in the Middle Ages, you could almost understand how they got away with it, because not so many people were literate. But now people are literate and they hold in their hands enough computing power, the same computing power apparently, that was available to send a man to the moon. So we're more educated, we've got access to more information, but we seem to want to know less.
Well, I think there's several things. One, I think what kind of education you get is really important. If the education is extremely specialized or ideological, I mean, I had, when I was coming up, my professors who were liberal, I had ones who were conservative, but we read the original texts, whether it was Nietzsche or Marx or whatever it was, we actually read the original text. That was very, very important. We also, in those days, we were expected to be able to support our arguments as opposed to assert things. And I think there's more and more that people simply assert certain things. I went to Berkeley. Berkeley was certainly not a conservative school, but there were conservatives there, and conservative ideas were part of the debate, and there were, you know, moderate liberals. And now the university systems are very, very tilted. In some schools, the balance of Republicans to the Democrats or liberals to conservatives is 120 to 1.
Mm. It's not only there, though, is it? I mean, you mentioned that under 10% of the faculty at leading law schools like Harvard, Yale, Stanford, Columbia and Berkeley describe themselves as conservative. But equally in the United Kingdom, the figures that you use are roughly half of British voters leaning to the right, but only 12% of academics. And you think it's similar in Canada and Europe. And that sort of highlights why so many people feel as if those who they describe as the elite, or I describe as the managerial class, are just out of touch.
Well, you know, because they are. I did a show in Australia at a conference, and they asked me to talk about suburbia. And the host was a woman who has a show on ABC and, you know, lives in Melbourne, very sophisticated, you know, very smart. And she was basically talking about, well, why would people live in these suburban wastelands? And I'm sitting there saying, you're in a country where 80% of the people live in suburbs. I mean, what country do you come from? I mean, you know, and the country she comes from, and we have the same things in other countries, whether it's in France or Germany or the U.S. or England, they live in a very specific world. Expensive, not a lot of children, very much, you know, sort of inner city, sophisticated kinds of people, and they just talk to each other. But the problem is that they completely control most of the internet and most of the media and most of entertainment. So the vast majority of people are just completely on the outside.
Mm. Now, to, I think you use the word purge, but the constant attacks on a conservative or more traditional liberal thought is a pretty worrying thing for the democratic system because, well, I think so, because the idea is that the man in the street, the woman in the street, gets to choose. But if the ideas are squashed before they get before the people, then the people don't get to choose.
Well, and I think what we may see is if, for instance, you got complete control by the current, what's happened to the left. You know, I come from the Democratic Party myself, so I'm not a creature of the right at all. But I think that what's happened is it's become increasingly authoritarian because there's a sense that they have the moral and scientific truth and that that is the only truth. And in our tradition, which is, you know, great Anglo-Saxon tradition, there's always the idea that truth is, to some extent, a question of, you know, different perspectives, and that, you know, the conservative perspective may have some good things, the liberal perspective may have some good things, and we can debate about them. But if you believe essentially, and you use the term managerial, it's a very good term, but if you believe that there really is only one solution to every problem and only one way of dealing with things, then it becomes very, very difficult to have any sort of serious debate, because if you're right, then why would you even acknowledge the other side? If there's only one answer, then there's no need for debate. That's why in the medieval church, you know, you didn't debate the existence of God. You didn't debate the nature of Christ. You couldn't debate these things because there was a dogma. And if you violated the dogma, you were a heretic. And that's sort of where we're headed.
Yeah, it's a very worrying point. We've probably got a situation where the elites, or as I say, the management class, I know some who believe they ought to be able to control the world. In other words, they don't really think that people who don't have an academic education, meaning post-university education, have got much to offer. And they don't seem to understand the basic premise of a democracy, for starters, that every man and woman has the right to have a say in who governs them. And they also don't seem to understand that whether you're bright or not is not indicated by whether you went to university. That's just where you learn some things that later maybe turn out to be useless. There's a real disregard for people who've learned a trade and who, frankly, are as bright as the people who go to university.
Well, look, I think about my grandmother who didn't graduate high school, you know, came to the United States around 1900, spoke five languages, was a very active member of the Socialist Party in the United States, but incredibly brilliant, had all sorts of experiences, saw all kinds of things. I learned more from her than I would learn from somebody who had a college degree. Or like if when I go visit a company, like I was at the Toyota plant in Long Beach last week, the experiences of the guys managing that situation, and here's what really happens, and here's what the regulation meant we had to do. Those are incredibly invaluable lessons that you learn, and that's part of the sort of knowledge pool. And that knowledge pool doesn't necessarily have to come from a PhD. More PhDs doesn't make people smarter.
No, some people say that what it means is you know a hell of a lot about very little.
Yeah,
that is your particular topic. Joel, this is a very worrying trend, disregarding the past, wiping out that in the past, which you don't like now, and therefore losing perspective on where we've come from and maybe therefore not understanding where we are. It's been a pleasure talking to you, Joel Kotkin, the Presidential Fellow in Urban Futures at Chapman University. Thanks for joining us.
It's my pleasure.